Hello, and welcome to Legal Management Talk, the official podcast of the Association of Legal Administrators. I'm your host, Justin Askenazy. There's no secret that alcohol plays a large role in law firm events. Staff parties, colleague get-togethers, and even meetings with clients can often revolve around sharing cocktails or a bottle of wine. But that can also lead to problems for those who start to depend on alcohol to escape from the stressful environment of the legal industry. Joining us today is Eric Weber, who is the Program Director for the Legal Professionals Program and the Senior Clinician for Specialty Services at Karen Treatment Centers, a leading nonprofit addiction and behavioral healthcare treatment center. Eric was recently featured in the legal management article, An Honest Conversation About Alcohol, part of the wellness-themed print issue, which is hitting mailboxes now. Welcome, Eric. It's great to have you on the show.
Hi, Justin. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So first, how prevalent are issues with alcohol in the legal industry? Are they more common among lawyers or support staff, or is it a mix of both?
I think it's pretty well known that, you know, alcohol use and alcohol abuse is pretty prevalent. I think we know that both anecdotally and through research that's been done in the past 5 to 6 years and has been published in journals. One of the things we're seeing is that through research that the alcoholism rate among attorneys in particular, which has been measured, is anywhere from 2 to 3 times higher the rate than in the general population. So I think, you know, the research demonstrates that looking specifically at attorneys. I think if you look at the broader viewpoint of the firm, attorneys plus all of the rest of the staff that's involved, really just look around at what Christmas parties look like, what conferences look like, what treats look like, dinners, entertaining, being entertained, whatnot. And I think, you know, anecdotally, you can look around and say, yeah, there's a lot of alcohol consumption and probably at an unhealthy rate at a lot of the time.
So I understand that alcohol isn't the only addiction that has taken hold at legal organizations. What other substances are being used, and what effect does that have on the workplace?
Yeah, we've taken a look at alcoholism. We've taken a little bit less of a look at other substances. And I think when we take a look at self-report for the research, people are willing to say, yeah, they drank. What people are not willing to talk about as much as some of the other substances. Two of the substances that I hear about most as a treatment provider are both opioids and stimulants. And, you know, I want to be very clear that we take a look at opioid use or stimulant use. There is a segment of society, that population, that uses them as prescribed, non-problematically, no abuse. I think probably more important to the topic for today is discussing the struggle in abusing, becoming dependent on these particular substances. With the opioids, it's no mystery. Turn on the news. There's an opioid crisis across the country, across the world, major metropolitan areas and outside. People overdosing at alarming rates. And people in the legal profession are not going to be immune to that. So we're going to see that. A lot of times that will start, anecdotally, again, what I hear from my patients, a lot of times starts as a sports injury as a teenager or in college. You know, pushing your body. There's an injury and an opioid gets prescribed, taken as prescribed, then a little bit more, and eventually an abuse pattern develops. That is not an uncommon experience. The other substance that I hear a lot about is stimulants. A lot of ADHD medication, whether that's being prescribed first in high school or college, or when somebody gets to law school, says, look, I really need to focus. I need to be, you know, laser focused. I need to have a lot of energy, where your stimulant medications, again, are prescribed and then start getting them in other methods, whether that's buying it off your buddy down the hallway, or, you know, dealer off the street or off the internet or what have you. And then that continues as somebody gets into the legal field then. And I think one of the biggest problems with the stimulant abuse is that at first it works. I mean, it does what it's supposed to do. It keeps you up and gets you laser focused. The problem is when somebody is high for that long, eventually they've got a crash. And what that crash looks like is usually somebody completely shutting down. And how long that shutdown, the body needs for that shutdown to heal, eventually starts to affect productivity. So it can be a slow monster to grow, but it becomes a monster nonetheless. I think people aren't as open about it as they might be with the alcohol, because alcohol is legal, it's socially acceptable. We have bars and restaurants where you go get alcohol. I don't know any restaurant that has Adderall on the menu. Maybe coming soon, I don't know. But it's just, it's just not in the social fabric the way we do things. And I think there's also the sense of, it's okay to imbibe an alcohol where you start, going to the bathroom, popping pills or snorting lines off your desk or whatever you're doing. It's a little less socially acceptable depending on, kind of the crowd you're running with. So that's a very long answer to a short question. But I think it's important to take a look at the impact of stimulants and the culture around them, as well as the opioids.
Sure. So what can managers do when they suspect someone may be struggling with substance addiction?
Well, I think two important things, two important aspects to answer that question are looking at both policy and culture. So when a manager says, gee, I think somebody here's, got a problem, is there a policy? Do we know what the policy is? Is it an effective policy? Has the policy been updated to reflect where we're at today in society and how the firm negotiates or, operates in society? So knowing the policy is incredibly important. And if somebody doesn't know the policy, knowing where to find it or who to ask about it, going to HR or whoever and saying, look, what is our policy around this? What's our rights, responsibilities? What's our ethical liabilities here? If the person suspected of having a problem is a licensed attorney or administrative staff, depending what their position is, do they have licensing issues, ethical issues? There's some things to think about in that realm. And I think the second part that's also really important is culture. What's the culture of the firm? What's the culture of the workspace? Is it a culture where people are really supportive? Is it a culture where it's a little more competitive and it's more just kind of bring them in, grind them out, send them on their way? Depending on what the nature of that is, I think it's important to understand with the culture how somebody may react within that culture. And how the culture may or may not be supportive of somebody who's struggling with substances in order to get treatment, get help, get well, and come back and be a productive member of the organization. So being keenly aware of both those things is, I think, is incredibly important, or at least learning about them. Another aspect is documentation for managers, being able to document what the concerns are in an objective behavioral sense. So in other words, if we notice that somebody's always 15 minutes late, just documenting that. Noticing that somebody is maybe a little less attentive. Well, what does that mean? Can we give it time and a date? And that's not to be punitive. It's actually to just observe and say, look, we've noticed these things. This could be a result of substance use, substance abuse, substance dependence. And if the culture and the policy are there, we want to be able to support you in this. I think that can be incredibly important. But documentation for a manager in particular, documentation is incredibly important because it can be a liability. Hey, you know what? I think you're drinking too much. Whoa, hostile work environment. Like, how are you saying this to me? Like, where are you coming from? And so that can be a real gray area. It can be a real, a lot of thin ice that you're treading on. So with documentation, it provides a platform to say, look, here's what we're observing. We have concerns. Let's talk about this because it's job performance. And here's how we're measuring that. And then it's a little less subjective. It can be a little daunting at times. It can be feel like, hey, I'm a private investigator of the organization, a private investigator of this department or this group. But in the end, it makes, if there has to be something done with the employee with the suspect of having an issue, it just makes the job that much cleaner and on some level easier. You can be very direct. So again, a long answer to a short question, but I think it's an important question to answer.
Yeah, you mentioned having an effective policy for everybody to know and follow. What would an example of that be?
An effective policy would be clear expectations, understandings of what fit for duty and work is. In other words, is it a policy that somebody that you're allowed to have alcohol or not allowed to have alcohol in your office? What is the policy on if somebody wants to take a medical leave for substance abuse? What does that look like? Policy around taking paid time or unpaid time off. Policy around using PTO or not using PTO. Policy around how does the benefits, how do the benefits implement this? In other words, are there behavioral health benefits in the insurance package, that sort of stuff. As well as what is the correct word? So the word I want to use, what is the pecking order? What is the food chain? What is the chain of command in order to address an issue with a colleague or an employee? So is it a case where, look, it's my peer. Do I go do something or do I have to go somewhere else to do something? Or is it my direct subordinate or I'm responsible? Or is it somebody else's subordinate or I'm not directly responsible? Sort of navigating what the chain of command and what proper lines of communication look like. I think those would be some examples of policies we'd want to, you know, be mindful of.
Sure. So we've talked about managers. On the flip side, what can someone who's struggling do to ensure that they get the help they need?
Again, great question. I think we're going to start at the same place. If somebody who's struggling with substance abuse wants to find some help, again, what are the policies? What are the policies in place? What are the things set up to help somebody? What will the challenges and hurdles be? And also, what's the culture of the organization? You know, there is the policy of you go see this person, but the culture might be, look, here's the other, you know, this person may be, you know, policy says go see HR, but culture is go see this particular partner. He or she is the one who really helps navigate, you know, when somebody's struggling with a personal issue or a health issue, and they can be extremely, extremely guiding in that. Maybe it's somebody on the wellness committee. And you say, look, I'm really looking for an ally in my particular group. So understanding where, you know, people's are understanding compassionate, I think, is quite important. I think seeing what the resources are. Is there an EAP? Is there preferred providers? Is there a wellness group that you could go to and ask for suggestions? What is involved in what's included in one's healthcare benefits package? Is there certain wellness and health things that somebody can do? I think those are important things to think about if somebody said, look, I need some help. And quite frankly, knowing the laws, the employment laws in your state, and depending on, again, where you are in the organization, the standings are different if somebody, say, a senior managing partner or a managing partner or partner versus somebody who's administrative staff who's considered an employee. The laws are different for those, employment laws are different for those two, you know, segments. So, again, understanding what policy, what culture, and kind of what your rights within the organization are. I think more and more it's becoming a little more normal to say, hey, look, I'm struggling with something, you know, I need to take a little time, especially since COVID has hit, you know, a couple of years ago. And I remember seeing on television public service ads for being mindful of depression, being mindful of anxiety, being mindful of isolation, and encouraging people to take care of themselves. And somebody mentioned the other day, actually in a therapy group, the Great Resignation, that lots of people are kind of moving around. And so what we have culturally right now is a shift where people are able to say, hey, look, I'm struggling a little bit. I need to make a change, or I need to take some time for myself. And whether they want to be specific about being substance abuse oriented, or just, hey, look, I just, you know, struggling a little bit with my mental health, or just kind of my spiritual wellness. I think globally, when I say globally, you know, in the grand culture, it's getting a little easier to ask for help. There's a little less of a stigma. I think we're making some steps forward with that. But again, coming back around to policy and culture, knowing those two things and getting a handle on that, seeing how to best take those next steps.
Gotcha. So the legal management article discusses how prevalent alcohol is in the legal industry, such as at events like client meetings and firm outings. In response, and you've already touched on this, you suggest that firms establish a culture that places less emphasis on alcohol. Why is it important that organizations do so?
I think it's important that organizations do so because we're becoming increasingly aware of the problem. You know, the problem's always been there. let's not kid ourselves. The problem's always been there. I think we're, you know, entering an age. I think the profession is growing at a space where health is becoming more important. Overall wellness is becoming more important. It's less acceptable to go to a 3-martini lunch or have 4 beers after work at the office and then drive home because risk of DUI. No longer a case where the, you know, where the police officers just be like, all right, you get in the back, I'll drop you off at home. Now it's, I'm taking you to the county lockup. You're looking at 30 days in jail for your first DUI, depending what state you're in. It's not a joke. And so I think we're also taking a look at the impact on associates. You know, the data on associate turnover is staggering. I won't go into great detail of that. You know, at the ALA conference, there was a presentation by Decipher Investigative Intelligence where they talked about the massive turnover and attrition that's happening in big law at this point. And so we take a look at that and how can we start to work with that? How can we start to deal with that? And so when we take a look at somebody who's struggling with substance abuse, that, of course, is going to have an impact on somebody's productivity, somebody's ability to last a long time in the profession, a very tough profession to last in a lot of ways. So I think it's important for organizations to start to promote wellness for their employees for the organization's own benefit. If their employees are well, the organization is going to be well. If the employees are not well, the organization is going to suffer. An organization is what? A bunch of people getting together trying to do something. So I think if we just think even in just kind of theoretical terms, kind of macro, like healthy people mean a healthy organization in a lot of ways. If we can promote that, then the organization has a better chance of growing and being more and more healthy. So I think that's an important piece of it. I think, you know, it's important for organizations to demonstrate and promote healthy behavior because people won't do it on their own. You know, I think it's very much a top-down process where from an organizational standpoint, as well as top management, to say, look, we want to promote this because we want you to feel comfortable with it. And if you feel comfortable with it, you're more likely to engage. And so, you know, taking a look at how that will filter down, and that takes time. It's not like I'm going to say, okay, we're just going to put a whole lot of seltzer water on the bar instead of a whole lot of beers, and everybody's just going to enjoy that, and everybody's going to flip like that. But over time, you can change culture within an organization and for the better.
Definitely. So, in that same vein, how can administrators set up events that don't include alcohol but are still fun and keep lawyers, staff, and clients engaged?
I think I mentioned this in the article. One of the things that struck me at the ALA conference a couple of months ago was late at night. I was up having a meeting and another meeting, and we were out in the courtyard just kind of getting some fresh air because it had cooled off a bit. And there was a big group of people playing Duck, Duck, Goose. And I had put this big, stupid smile on my face. It just cracked me up because I haven't played Duck, Duck, Goose since like first grade. And that was back in the Stone Age. I'm older than I look. And it struck me that, you know, when we start talking about how to get people involved in healthy activities, it's things that people want to do. You know, one of the things I think about is the nostalgia of my childhood, Duck, Duck, Goose and other games and other activities that I go, oh man, I remember that wasn't that great. And the fact is it didn't involve alcohol. You know, I don't remember being drunk in first grade and playing Duck, Duck, Goose. College, maybe a different story. But, you know, when we go back to some of the, you know, the childhood things and taking a look at the age demographic and sort of that culture demographic, whether you're dealing with, you know, the baby boomers, Gen X, Gen Y, millennials, and on down, I'm starting to lose track of what letter we're on in the alphabet. But what are the things that are important to those particular folks? I'm a Gen Xer. So for me, you know, music, a particular type of music or activities can be really, really important. So you say, okay, look, you know, we're going to promote this. We're going to have a DJ. What kind of music do we want to play? Well, who are the folks that are going to be there and how to engage them? You know, and having other activities, you know, such as, you know, the obvious hiking, yoga. I was at a lawyer assistance program in North Carolina last year. And, they had 2 activities on the one day. You either go fishing or you go golfing. And it was great because that's what these folks do. And it was a great way, you know, it was obviously a lawyer assistance program, it was, you know, a sober event. And, you know, it was a great way to set up just some social time with things people enjoy. So I think being mindful of what people want to get involved with, what would attract them, and being creative. Like, I don't care if you have finger painting, whatever. Be creative. What would people go, oh, wow, I haven't done that. Or that's really cool. Or, hey, I saw this thing. That's really neat. And giving it a try. And I would also say getting senior management involved in a way, if that's helpful for them to sort of lead the charge, like, okay, team, we're all doing this together, and doing it as a team building exercise, I think can also be pretty powerful.
What about the firm's culture as a whole? Are there incentives that can be offered to ensure employees are focusing on wellness amid their stressful days?
I think so. I think that, again, there's subtle and not so subtle ways. Reflecting upon the organization I work at, Care and Treatment Center, we are offered a discount on our insurance if we engage in wellness activities. All right, you're going to hand me money to go to the doctor. I'm going to the doctor anyways. Not a problem. You want me to take 20 minutes and fill out this wellness screen? Fine. So I think on a very concrete level, if you offer me a discount on my insurance, and a lot of insurance brokers like this sort of stuff because it gets the employees involved. If they become healthier, then it reduces healthcare costs overall. If people are less sick, it costs the insurance industry less money. They make more money. Everybody's happy. So I think there's some systemic ways that we can help that. I think there's also some less concrete, but very effective ways as well. In so far as even just supervisors checking with employees of what they need to take care of themselves. One of the things I used to tell my staff when I supervised a couple of treatment teams, it's like, look, I can't give you more money or less work, but I can give you time. So are you done for the day? Go home. I remember a young man worked for me. He had his first baby. And every Friday at 2 o'clock, instead of 4 o'clock, I'd be, dude, is your work done? Go home, go be a dad. You know, you're not getting these years back. And for him, it was an incentive to be really productive through the week so that he could take half a day and just take it, never charge PTO for it. I could do that as a manager, something I had liberty to do. I think for managers and for organizations to say, look, how can we promote this? I had a patient one time who ran an outdoor goods company. And what he did was he would take a break, usually at least once or twice a week, and everybody would have their bicycle in the office. And he would insist everybody go bicycling. Now they lived in Colorado. And they were able to do that environmentally as possible. But being creative that way, if you're in a space, you say, hey, we have this beautiful green space. All right, we're taking the meeting at the green space. I would take my staff for pizza for meetings sometimes. Why? Let's not do it in the office. Let's go for lunch. Now, I can afford a couple of bucks to make sure my staff feels cared for and really paying attention to their wellness. Again, being creative and knowing your audience, I think you can do this on a very micro level with just people around you. You know, hey, we're all going to take a half an hour and go to lunch or get lunch. And we're just going to sit around a conference table and we're not going to look at briefs. We're just going to do this. Making sure that, you know, you're checking with people with how they're doing, how things with you, how things with your family, not being prying, but just letting people know that you care. I think those little things go a long way. So again, a long answer to a short question, but I think we take a look at it both from the macro and the micro. There's lots of things that we can do to help promote wellness among the organization, the people within it.
Definitely. So what about if an attorney or staff member is feeling stressed or burned out? What are some healthy ways for them to cope instead of turning to alcohol or other stimulants?
I think one of the most important things and one of the most difficult things is what I'll say, carving out time and setting boundaries. Very, very difficult in today's culture and in the legal profession overall, very, very difficult to carve out time and to keep boundaries. But I would say that is an exercise that needs to be done. And carving out time for oneself, and whether that's taking, you know, a walk, whether it's taking some time to sit and meditate, pray, whether it's time taken from 7 o'clock to 7:30, I'm on East Coast time and watching Jeopardy and just getting most of the answers wrong, but still trying my best. But I'm not going to check my email from 7 to 7:30. Unless somebody's having a heart attack, then you send them to the hospital. The place is on fire. Call the fire department. 7 to 7:30, I want to sit. I want to watch Jeopardy, veg out. And at 7:30, I'll get back into that. It's a silly example. Happens to be a true one, by the way. It's a silly example. But it's an example of little things that somebody can do.
For sure. So one more thing I want to touch on is resiliency. Mm-hmm. It's something we hear a lot about, especially related to wellness. What does it mean to build resilience, and what are the best ways to do that?
Well, I think it's important to understand that resiliency isn't something you're born with. It's actually a skill set. Some people are more naturally resilient. Some people may not be more naturally resilient, but you can build resilience in a skill set. And resilience is really about repelling all the nonsense in the universe that's coming at you, or at least dealing with it, right? It's being able to navigate, even absorb some of this stuff, and just not have it impact you in a negative way. So for me, resilience isn't necessarily ignoring stuff. It's recognizing that it's there, saying, okay, and I can deal with it in this way or that way, either turning my brain off or reformulating it, or just being able to absorb it and just pass it through, what have you. I think it's understanding what your feelings are about what's impacting you. How do you manage the feelings? How do you manage that energy? That it doesn't start wearing you down. And again, resilience is about understanding that the issues are there and how do you best need to take care of yourself. One of the things that I wanted to mention is the idea of connection. You know, in resilience and self-care, the really important part of connection, and connection on two levels. Connection with oneself. Do I really know what's going on within me? Or am I just sort of robotically going through my day and getting the work done and getting the job done and that's it, go to bed, get up, repeat? Do I have a real emotional understanding, awareness? You know, mentally, how am I doing? Am I connected with myself? And then am I connected with the world around me? Am I connected with the world around me, or am I disconnected because I don't have the resilience to deal with it? I just sort of shut it off, walled it off, which is very common, especially when we talk about attorneys in particular, that idea of just walling things off and just getting the job done. And for a lot of administrative staff, dealing with the attorney is probably the same thing. We call it professionalism. A lot of times it's just turning off your emotions, getting the job done, going home, and either drinking it away, sleeping it away, drugging it away, or bitching it away. In moderation, but again, as we're talking about, abuse happens, dependence happens. We want to be mindful that there's other things to be done. So when we talk about resilience is really a skill set to be able to deal with the crap that the universe is giving you in a healthy way that it doesn't wear you down.
Great. I appreciate all the insight you've given us today. Thanks so much for talking with me, Eric.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our listeners and subscribers for tuning in. If you like the show, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so that you never miss an episode. As always, you can learn more about ALA at alanet.org. Until next time.